I'm Joy Cardine with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, September the 14th. And today, by the way, is the start of Wisconsin's Eat Local Challenge. It runs September 14th through the 23rd. It's an effort by a number of state and local groups, including the state's Agriculture Department, to encourage state residents, to encourage you to spend at least 10% of your food budget on foods produced within 100 miles of your home. Will you be participating in this? Do you already try to eat locally as much as possible? Or don't you think about where your food comes from? Well, our guest this hour says we should think about where our food comes from. He's Michael Pollan, author of the best-selling book, now out in paperback, called The Omnivore's Dilemma. And we will welcome your thoughts and questions for him about the social, ethical, and environmental implications of our food choices. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Michael Pollan teaches journalism at Berkeley. He's a longtime contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. He's the author of several books, including The Botany of Desire and The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thanks a lot for being with us.
Sure.
Well, I don't know if you knew this, but today is the start of this Eat Local Challenge in Wisconsin. Do you think this is a good idea?
I think it's an excellent idea. You know, these things are starting to happen around the country. There was one around here that was, you know, a lot, they tried to do a lot more than 10%, and a group of really hardcore locavores, as they've become to be known, succeeded in doing everything. They even found, you know, wheat, which is not easy to find in California, so they could make bread locally. I think, you know, whether people can, on a long-term basis, eat their whole diet from within 100 miles may be very challenging, but the process of trying to do so becomes quite an education in what is available locally, how good the quality of local agriculture has become in so many places, and the pleasures of getting back in tune with the seasons.
Yeah. Why would someone even want to even consider participating in something like this, trying to find foods within 100 miles of where you live?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. I mean, it depends on, you know, what your concerns are as a citizen and as a consumer and as a parent. I mean, a lot of people are concerned about the energy impact of their food choices. It's only recently been recognized, but that the way we eat has as much impact on climate change as what we drive or how we heat our houses, because we have moved to an energy-intensive food system, largely because we're moving food around so much, but also because the way we grow it on a massive industrial monoculture scale requires huge amounts of fossil fuel for the fertilizer, for the pesticides, for the equipment. And with the result that it now takes about 10 calories of fossil fuel energy to produce 1 calorie of food in America. Now, you go back 100 years, and it took, for every calorie of fossil fuel energy you put into growing food, you got 2 calories of food, because it was essentially a solar-driven system, which is how it should be. You know, photosynthesis is really how to produce food, not by turning cheap oil into commodity corn, into commodity beef, into commodity hamburgers. So one reason to eat locally is to reduce your carbon footprint. The same reason you might buy a smaller car or a hybrid car. In fact, you can have just as much impact if you stop eating industrially produced meat as switching to a Prius. So that's one reason. The other reason is when you eat locally, you tend to eat more healthy. Because local food tends not to be highly processed. It doesn't have all that added fat and high fructose corn syrup and additives that go into the typical supermarket pre-cooked meal. Because one of the things you'll find is, and this is part of the education I'm talking about, is that when you start to eat locally, you start to cook. Because if you are shopping at the farmer's market or joining a CSA, which is one of these box schemes, you know, where you get a box of produce from the same farm every week, you will not find anything microwavable in that box or at that farmer's market. You will not find processed food. You're going to find delicious, tasty, nutritious raw ingredients that you're going to have to then cook. And if you want to do one single thing to improve your health around food, it is starting to cook and getting off fast food.
Yeah. I'll have to put that on my list.
Some people now look at cooking as incredibly daunting and they don't have the time. But in fact, it's become something of a subversive act in our culture, I think, to cook. We spend more time watching cooking shows than we actually cook. No single act can do more for your health and the health of your family.
You just described my life. No, I do cook a little bit, but you know what? You don't have to cook a great Wisconsin apple. I mean, you can, but.
That's true. I mean, there's plenty of food you don't have to cook at the farmer's market. And in fact, eating an apple compared to your typical, packaged snack food, even if it's wearing a health claim, is, infinitely superior. And then one other reason, and there's so many, but is the fact that by eating locally, you are keeping agriculture in Wisconsin. There is a drift toward globalized agriculture. All our food is going to be coming from Mexico and China unless people start to eat locally. The Central Valley of California is in danger of being completely paved over by houses. That's where most of our produce is coming from now. The apple industry in the Northwest and in Wisconsin is under tremendous threat from cheap Chinese apples. Yeah. So if we like having farmers in our community, if we like the way the Wisconsin landscape looks, which is to say a patchwork of small family farms, then we need to eat locally to keep these people going. Because the way you stop sprawl and the way you stop the flight of agriculture from America is by eating local produce.
We are talking with Michael Pollan. He is author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals, taking a look at the benefits of eating locally, a look at how what we eat, whether industrial, organic, processed, or natural, has what effects that has on our future, on our world. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Wondering if you already try to eat locally, or if you put a lot of thought into where your food comes from and what's for dinner. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's coming up on 19 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, September the 14th. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. After 5 o'clock this afternoon, Ben's guest says, think before you click. Whether at work, school, or anywhere, there are times when email is not the best option, and it might land you in hot water. So talking about email coming up after 5 o'clock this afternoon. We are talking about what we eat and knowing where our food comes from and whether we would be better off if we would eat more foods that are produced locally. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We are talking with the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma this hour, Mike Pollan, who thinks we should know what we are eating and we should make more conscious choices of what we eat for our own pleasure, for our own health, and for the health of the environment. And we happen to be talking to him today, not only because his best-selling book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, has recently been released in paperback. This book was named one of the 10 best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review. But coincidentally, it is also the start today of Wisconsin's Eat Local Challenge, where the state's agriculture department and a number of state and local groups are encouraging you to spend at least 10% of your food budget on foods produced within 100 miles of where you live. Can you do this? Are you thinking about doing this? Will you be doing this? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We'll go to the phones in just a moment, Michael Pollan, but remind us, besides being the title of your book, what is The Omnivore's Dilemma?
Well, the omnivore's dilemma is something faced by any creature like humans that can eat a great many different things in nature. You know, we're not like cows who know exactly what to eat. They just eat grass. Or koala bears who just eat eucalyptus leaves. We can eat almost anything nature has to offer. That's a wonderful opportunity, but it's also a huge challenge because there are things you shouldn't eat. There's things that'll make you sick. There are mushrooms out there that'll kill you. So how do you navigate that? Well, traditionally, we had something called a culture that did that, a food culture, which is a fancy, you know, culture, and when it comes to food, is a fancy word for your mom, essentially, is the person who passes down the culture's information about what is good to eat and what is bad to eat. In modern times, that culture has really broken down. Mom's authority over the dinner menu has been diminished, and now it's really the food industry and nutrition scientists and, you know, advice columns in the newspaper that are telling people what to eat, and therefore there's a huge amount of confusion.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the modern supermarket, we're sort of back where we were on the primitive landscape, trying to figure out, is this tasty morsel going to kill me because it has trans fats in it, or is this really going to be good for me? So there's a lot of confusion around what should be a very simple decision, what to eat. And it's reflected in our lack of health. I mean, you know, 4 of the top 10 killers in this country now are chronic diseases linked to diet. Diabetes, a disease, type 2 diabetes, a disease that takes, you know, 13 years off of your life, is approaching 10% of the population. This is something that is completely avoidable with a proper diet.
Yeah, and then we also get scares in the news again that those of us who are trying to maybe eat more vegetables, organic produce, we get E. coli scares.
Yeah, well, we had a very serious one last year with spinach from the Central Valley of California, and there is a tremendous food safety problem in the system, and which flows largely from the way we've industrialized our agriculture. Few people realize that the E. coli that is so lethal, this 0157H7, didn't exist 30 years ago. It was really a creation of huge cattle feedlots. Where it evolved because of the diet that we feed our cows, which is to say lots of corn and grain, which does something to their digestive system that made it a happy environment for this terrible bug. So, you know, the way we've industrialized our food, the scale on which we're growing it, is jeopardizing our health in many, many ways, not to mention the health of the environment because of the, you know, animal agriculture has become one of the biggest sources of water and air pollution in this country. So we're growing food in a way that makes it very cheap and very accessible, but also less safe and less wholesome and a real environmental problem. And one of the benefits of eating locally is to support an alternative agriculture that is growing, you know, meat in a way that's good for the land, that doesn't produce E. coli, that is, you know, going to produce more wholesome food.
Yeah, and in the book, you do trace the source of a number of meals and foods, and one of them was the pre-washed organic bag of greens from California.
Yeah, and I spent time in the very facility where that E. coli outbreak to which it was traced, and the best, you know, they've never really narrowed it down, but what they think it was is a field of greens that was close to a cattle operation, and somehow the E. coli got from the cattle manure into the you know, there's always a risk of that sort of thing happening in food. One of the reasons it's become a big problem today is the scale on which we're doing things. I mean, one facility in California is washing the lettuce for, you know, something like 80 million servings a week. You know, it's as if we were washing the nation's entire salad in a single sink. And when you do that, and there is the inevitable problem in that sink, which sooner or later is likely to happen, it's going to make a whole lot of people sick. Whereas when you have a highly decentralized food system, when more people are eating locally, there will still be food safety problems, but they will be quarantined. That, you know, a food safety problem in California won't leave California. A food safety problem in Wisconsin won't leave Wisconsin. The model of food safety used to be, you know, the church supper, where Aunt Mabel did something wrong with the potato salad and left it out in the sun too long, and you know, she killed a couple people, but she didn't kill hundreds, and she didn't put thousands of people in the hospital. So, you know, it's still a problem, but the scale of it changes completely with the industrialization of agriculture.
Lots of callers for you. Cindy in Blanchardville. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I will just say that I've been lucky enough this year to transition into exactly something that you're speaking of. We grow, my husband and I grow right now on an acre of land a good percentage of our vegetables. We, in order to get my dairy needs met and also some of our fruit needs met, I trade time on farms for goods. And by doing that, I've been able to really develop a relationship with some local farmers to share ideas. I've found that the culture of information sharing is very alive and well if you're open to it versus a culture like you were talking about where food is something that you buy at a store instead of learning how to cook it, how to prepare it, how to can it and store it. I'm finding that a lot of the elders in this community are really willing to share that information with people who want to go back to that way of life. I will say that it's been a joy. One of the hardest problems has been the amount of time that it takes up to prepare all of your own food from planting the seeds to actually doing the harvesting and canning. Anyway, I want to thank you for your book and the information that you've shared with the communities because it's really been instrumental for a lot of people like myself.
Thank you, Cindy.
Well, thank you very much, Cindy. I appreciate that. You know, you point to something that I didn't mention. Of course, the most local food of all is food that you grow yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And people really overlook the incredible potential that they can have in their own back or ideally front yard by growing, you know, by putting in a garden. I recently put in a small garden in my house. I live on a city lot in Berkeley. It's only 10 by 20 feet, I would say. But we've been eating out of it all summer. An immense amount of food can come out of a small space. And it does take some time. But, you know, I took it out of my exercise time. So much of us spend, you know, time running or walking or, you know, playing basketball or golf or whatever. But there's something really nice about doing physical labor that has a point instead of taking your body out for a walk. As Wendell Berry described it. So, you know, to actually work in support of your body that way is a very satisfying process. And, of course, you know exactly everything about the food you grow yourself. You know whether it has pesticides or not. You know, and it cannot possibly be fresher. So that is, you know, that is something that I think, especially for people who complain that eating locally costs more, because it does, and that, you know, buying organic food is expensive and I can't afford it. Well, the savings on just having a garden in your yard is immense. It costs very, very little, and you get a massive amount of food.
We are talking with Michael Pollan, and we will continue after we check news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio. Michael Pollan is the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals, recently out in paperback, talking with us about the benefits of eating locally. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, 7:36 right now on this Friday, September the 14th, talking this hour about what we eat and what we should eat and what kind of ethical, social, or environmental implications are involved in our food choices. Wondering if we can change the world by making more thoughtful choices for what's for dinner? We're talking with the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma this hour, Michael Pollan, who thinks it's a good idea to know what we are eating and to make more conscious choices of what we eat. And we wonder if you already do this. What do you try to eat, or maybe what do you try to avoid eating? I'm also interested if you're considering participating in, or maybe you already know you will be participating in, the Wisconsin Eat Local Challenge, which starts today. It runs September 14th through the 23rd. It's an effort by a number of state and local groups, including the state's agriculture department, to encourage you to spend at least 10% of your food budget on foods produced within 100 miles of your home. Is this possible? Our guest says, certainly it is. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals, recently released in paperback. And our next caller is Kate in Prairie Farm. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joy and Michael. I'm a CSA farmer, and I send food to people who live in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Michael, I really enjoyed your book, and it was a real eye-opener about the use of corn. I had no idea, even as a farmer, how much we use that.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to thank you for your endorsement of CSAs. It's been a real help for me. But I also I wanted to say you've alluded to the impact on local economies by shopping local, but I think it goes further even than you've said, where money that comes to me as a local farmer is dispersed locally in my community. And for small rural economies, it's been very helpful to have money coming in from the city, which tends to have more purchase power and gets dispersed through the small farms into our local economy. That's been very helpful. The other comment I had was, though, that I think it's important to see farmers not in terms of good farmers and bad farmers, but that the farmers who are doing organic and doing local food are a product of a certain economy, and the other larger farmers are just trying to keep farming. It's been a tradition in their family, and they are the product of an economic system. They didn't make bad choices. They've had to make choices to survive.
Mm-hmm. I think you make a very good point, and there are two different farm economies now, and there is this growing local farm economy, and it offers opportunities to farmers that if you're growing commodity crops, you don't have a whole lot of choice about your agricultural methods, because if you can't produce corn at the going price, you're out of business, and therefore you've got to expand because your margins are so tiny. So you end up with a larger and larger farm that can only be run with more chemicals and more technology and more equipment. So I think that's absolutely true. And the other thing that happens when you're growing commodity crops is you really lose track of the eater at the other end of the food chain and what the eater wants. And the beauty of the CSA model or the farmer's market model is that you as a farmer, Kate, you get to look your customer in the eye once a week, and know what their needs are, what they care about in food, and there's this feedback loop, so that you are, literally feeding them and figuring out what they want to be eating, and that's a very healthy thing. I think your point about circulating money locally, though, is really, really important. I mean, there's such a drain of capital from the countryside to the city, largely because of industrial agriculture, which gets farmers, ensnares them in this very high capital economy where they have, I've talked to potato farmers who might make $1,300 on an acre, but they've got $1,250 in expenses that are going to, companies like Monsanto and Cargill and all the providers of agricultural imports. So to have a farm economy that's actually taking money from the cities and bringing it back to the rural economy has enormous potential to revive the countryside.
Yeah. Speaking of your corn insights, didn't you find out that practically every processed food in the world contains corn of some sort?
Well, in America, at least. I mean, one of the things I did was look at a McDonald's meal and try to figure out, where did it come from? What is it made of? When you buy that meal at McDonald's, you're mostly buying a pile of carbon. I mean, that's mostly what we eat. And the overwhelming majority of those atoms of carbon in the McDonald's meal came from corn, because corn is sweetening the soft drinks. Corn is what fed the chicken or the beef. Corn syrup is even in the rolls and the salad dressing and all the kind of, long word ingredients in that chicken nugget, the starch and the emulsifiers and the diglycerides and monoglycerides, they're all derived from corn. Corn is really the building block of the fast food nation. And it's quite impressive what this plant can do and what food scientists can tease out of a single crop. But the end result is we're eating from a monoculture. And monocultures are not good either for the land or for our health. We are omnivores. We need to eat between 50 and 100 different things to be healthy. And you're not going to get them all from a diet of processed corn.
Yeah. Thank you, Kate, for calling. Doug in Madison is with us now. Hi, Doug.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Michael. I wanted to build on the link between food consumption and fossil fuel consumption. There's a report out just last year from the United Nations that highlights that just the livestock sector alone among within agriculture produces a greater fuel consumption than the transportation sector does worldwide. And so I think not only so our food choices, and in particular are the top of the food chain, eating meat is a highly energy-intensive process, which argues for then, in fact, moving towards a more vegetarian diet, but perhaps that's it's another topic. I also wanted to highlight that tomorrow morning is a great opportunity for people to walk the walk if they believe in this, because the Dane County Farmers Market is up and going, and it's the biggest local market of its type in the nation, according to a number of sources. So there's an opportunity there.
Certainly is a super farmers market, and many communities all over Wisconsin have some wonderful farmers markets going tomorrow morning, too. Michael Pollan, you want to address
that? Yeah, well, I mean, I think the point about I'm familiar with that UN report, and it is true from an environmental point, getting off of meat is a very positive thing to do. It's growing meat the way we grow it is incredibly wasteful of resources. It wastes grain that could be feeding people. I mean, you know, you have to feed 10 pounds of corn to the average steer to get 1 pound of steak, and it's just not from an environmental point of view a very good way to go. That said, though, if the animals are on grass instead of on a feedlot eating grain, you know, they're eating something we can't eat, which is to say grass. And the environmental benefits of putting cows back on grass, whether it's for milk or for meat, you know, fly in the face of that. I mean, that is not a great user of energy. It's not a great waster of resources. And if you're grazing properly, you're actually improving the soil, and you're sequestering carbon in the soil because of the way you build soil by proper grazing techniques. So it's not meat. It's industrial meat. I think it's important to make that distinction. There are forms of ways of growing meat that actually is very environmentally beneficial. But we're not generally doing it that way. So if you can find a good, if you do want to eat meat and you do care about the environment and your health, well, then look out for some grass-fed meat. And I'm sure that there are people doing it in Wisconsin. You've got wonderful grass there. And then I think you'll be doing something very good for climate change and very good for your health and very good for the animals' happiness and very good for the farmer and very good for the grass itself.
Yeah. I think Dan and Wanakee might have a different view on that, though. Dan, go ahead.
Yeah, well, the last caller kind of took my point, but the bottom line is, I mean, I think local is great, but if you have the demand, I mean, if people are eating meat 2 to 3 times a day, every day, I mean, how many local farms can you do? I mean, when you have more animals than you do humans in your country, you're going to have methane gas, and you're going to have runoff into drinking water, so I think the message needs to be stronger. What you never hear from Al Gore or many environmentalists is we need to start eating more plants. It's just a longer, more sustainable idea.
Yeah.
And then secondly, just like to take a little bit of issue on calling human beings omnivores, and I'll make it quick because I know it's a little off. Anyone who thinks that we're meat eaters should try jumping on top of a cow and take a bite out of them, because omnivores in the wild can do that. And we can't. We don't have the teeth, the jaw strength. Our intestines are different and process the foods like a herbivore.
All right, Dan. I've got to stop for our weather break, and we will have Michael Pollan address your comments after weather. And then we'll take more calls. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Talking with our guest about the benefits of eating locally. And the benefits of knowing where your food comes from. Michael Pollan investigated this for his book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals. He's talking with us about what he learned and also talking with us on this, the start of Wisconsin's Eat Local Challenge, which runs September 14th through the 24th. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Stay tuned. Coming up after 8 o'clock, as we always do on Friday, it's the Week in Review. Two guests from different perspectives to talk with you about the news of the week. And that's what we'll do after 8. We're talking this hour, or for the rest of it anyway, with Michael Pollan. He is the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals. And a couple of comments on the table. Michael Pollan, a caller just before the weather break, saying that he takes issue with calling human beings omnivores. Apparently he doesn't think human beings are omnivores.
Well, you know, there's a lot of debate whether we're biologically designed to, you know, to eat this or that food. The evidence that I've seen suggests that we have the physiological equipment to eat all different kinds of things. And being an omnivore doesn't obligate you to eat any one thing. It means you can eat one thing. We clearly can digest meat. We have a digestive enzyme that is only there for the purpose of breaking down meat. So that suggests that meat eating has been an important part of our evolutionary past. But it, you know, when some people hear the word omnivore, they think you're saying, "Oh, we are naturally meat eaters. We must eat meat." And that's certainly not the case. We do very well without meat. We can get everything you get from meat from some other source, with animal protein from some other source, with the exception of B12, which you can get from eating a little bit of dirt or a fermented food. So, you know, we can get by fine without meat, and I think it would be a wonderful thing if more people did. I mean, I think the caller is absolutely right that meat eating is, from an environmental point of view and from a health point of view, doing it the way we do it, 2 to 3 times a day, is just crazy. We eat way too much meat. The Earth can't support. If the rest of the world started eating meat the way Americans do, we would be in enormous trouble. And watching meat eating increase in China as they industrialize is very alarming. Mm-hmm. I also agree that people like Al Gore should be talking about meat eating, and that it is as important part of the climate change issue as driving and heating cars and all the other things that he does address. And I don't understand quite why he's overlooked that, except a lot of people really have not been sensitized to the issue that eating meat is such a drain on the environment.
Yeah. Well, I do. I personally have a more plant-based diet. I was a vegetarian for many, many years. I still am for the most part, except I add fish. I've added fish. And here's my dilemma. If I want to eat locally, or really 100% locally, I wouldn't be able to have that wild Alaska salmon, would I?
No, you wouldn't. That's absolutely right. And I think it's a real question with the goal of eating 100% locally. I mean, we Americans are so all or nothing. We think, oh, it's local or global. But that's why I think the structure of the challenge in Wisconsin is so good. They're saying, you know, spend 10% of your income locally. You're not going to spend it all locally. People have been trading food for thousands and thousands of years. There's evidence, and seafood is very, very important to human health, and there's evidence that traditional cultures, even when they lived in the mountains, you know, hundreds of very difficult miles from the coast, would go to the trouble of trading for dried fish or fish eggs and things like that, because we have a profound need for omega-3 fatty acids, which the easiest way to get them is from fish. So the czars were eating oysters that had come from thousands of miles over land. This is not an unnatural thing, and we shouldn't condemn all food that comes from far away. The challenge is to get what you can get locally. I mean,
Sounds like we had a technical difficulty with Michael Pollan's phone line there, so we'll quickly try to call him back and get him back online. Maybe his call waiting could have interrupted the phone line, but he's back. Good.
I'm back. Yeah, I don't know what happened.
Yeah, just every once in a while we have a gremlin. Let me go back to the phone. Sarah in Viroqua, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Very much support the local challenge from the governor's office and from the State Department of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. I think it's great. And we live on a farm, and we are just starting in the last several years a grass-based beef cattle herd. And we raise and preserve much of our own fruits and vegetables, and what we don't preserve ourselves, I try to things that I'm not so successful with in our garden. I purchase from our neighbors, largely are Amish farmers, and I buy from our. We have a great local food co-op and farmers market. And so I think the local challenge is a really great idea. And I did read your book. I really enjoyed it, and I really appreciated the discussion of federal farm policy and the subsidies in particular for monocultures like corn and soybeans and how this relates to corporate vertically integrated animal husbandry and processing. But I don't believe that you mentioned what state governments are doing that benefit large animal confinement operations. For example, our state of Wisconsin here, who has a great history of small-scale family dairy farms, just implemented a law that preempts local governments from making decisions about the siting of large animal confinement facilities. And essentially what happens is that the county and townships their hands are tied in terms of creating or implementing any standards that are above and beyond the states in terms of environmental or public health regulations. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I know other states have these sorts of laws. And do you know anything in particular about that?
I do, and it's a scandal, actually. When communities have tried to regulate these corporations who bring in, tremendous hog confinement or dairy confinement operations that totally destabilize communities, pollute the waterways, stink up the airways, and really diminish the quality of life, the corporations who own these confinement deals go to the state legislatures and get laws passed saying that local zoning regulations, which work for all other cases, don't apply in this case. It's strictly a matter of these companies buying state governments, and it's something that needs to be fought because there are sacrifice counties in Missouri, I'm thinking of in particular, that have been completely turned over to these operations with disastrous effects at every level for local communities. So. Yeah. I think it's a political issue that is rising, and one of the problems is, of course, that there are a lot of rules on the books that say that farm structures and farm buildings and farm activities don't come under zoning. But if you've ever seen a confinement hog operation, to call that a farm is really a stretch. It's a factory, and it should be regulated like any other factory. It's putting enormous amounts of pollution into the environment. There's a loophole under which these corporations are operating, but the politics has to take place at the state and the federal level if we're going to have any kind of control. I think there will be a very powerful effort to curb the worst abuses of these companies. My concern is that when that happens, they will all move to Mexico. It's not like we will put them out of business or return to smaller animal agriculture, and that troubles me a lot.
Sarah, thank you for the call. Mark in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. I wanted to question this business of eating locally and challenge you to the idea that cities have a hard time eating local. How does the entire city eat locally? And I would suggest that a solution would be that the city become the farm. Here in Milwaukee, we have a group called Growing Power that is doing urban farming and is part of the larger urban agriculture movement. Out of Columbia University, there was a guy who was even on our radio program recently out of a group called verticalfarm.org. And maybe you could speak to the business of hydroponic agriculture and farmers measuring their productivity per square foot instead of per acre and being able to do so right in the urban environment.
Yeah, I think the caller makes a very good point. There is a lot of urban farming going on, and there's enormous potential. I don't know if you've followed what's happened in Havana, but after they lost their access to the Soviet Union for agricultural chemicals and tractors and all this kind of stuff, they had to figure out how to grow their own food very quickly. And one of the ways they did it was take every vacant lot in Havana and turn it into a garden, a farm. And Havana is now growing a tremendous percentage of its produce. If you look at Burlington, Vermont, there's another city in this country that is growing, I think, over 10% of its produce within the city limits. So there's great potential to grow food in the cities. And, of course, the farmers markets are a very good way that that cities can feed themselves. But I think, yeah, solving the problem of the cities with local agriculture is a challenge. The cost of land is obviously what makes it prohibitive. And in general, the cost of land is the great challenge for local agriculture. It's very hard for farmers to get in when land costs what it does. And most farmers, you know, live on land that their parents or grandparents or great-grandparents had the foresight to buy, so they don't have a land cost in the same way.
Yeah.
But the challenge is to make land available in the cities. There are also some very interesting city planning ideas that incorporate agricultural land into new developments in the same way that, say, golf courses are often incorporated, and that there'd be land for growing food in every new community, and that would be leased to farmers at reasonable rates.
We'll have to leave it at that thought since we're at the end of the hour. Michael Pollan, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Michael Pollan teaches journalism at Berkeley. He is the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and Cheryl Gasser and Leo Duran for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.